Hi, I'm Ben McAdams, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined by Dan McKay on the right.
Hello, everybody.
And by Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Always appreciate you tuning in.
So Natalie's out today, and you know, I have to confess, first of all, I'm an avid listener of the show, and I'm always a little bit disappointed when you have guest hosts in. So to those who are with me and love the regulars, Dan and Shireen and Natalie, my apologies, but Natalie will be back soon.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you, and it was so nice to find somebody who likes to be representing that political center, the middle.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is easy for us to find substitutes for me because, well, we live in Utah. It's harder to find a substitute for Shireen, but Natalie, for some reason, is really hard. But when Shireen recommended that maybe we could, you know, have you be the host, it clicked and it was like, oh, you know what? Actually, that we might have actually found someone who can carry Natalie's water. So welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. Good to be with you both. So let's just jump right in. First of all, we saw a couple of things happen this week that I think are noteworthy. Hurricane Ida. It's been over a week now since Hurricane Ida hit, and parts of Louisiana remain underwater more than a week later. It was one of the most powerful storms ever to hit the United States. More than 600,000 electricity customers in Louisiana still have no power. And the storm's death toll rose over the weekend to at least 63. At least 50 of those deaths came in the northeastern U.S. as Ida's remnants brought record rainfall and flash flooding into the New York City region. So what do we think about this? What are we learning about this?
Yeah, so I'm really concerned. Of course, we're hearing from climate scientists, and we have seen that the frequency and the strength of these storms are increasing. And what that means, I think, to our overall infrastructure, to the loss of life, what it means for us to be really prepared in the face of climate change is beyond a question. It's a reality that we're grappling with, and frankly, we're behind on. I don't know, Dan, what do you think?
Well, you know, I understand there is a lot of doom and gloom that goes along with a hurricane, especially one that comes in this force. I'll just highlight, you know, and not that this is by any means positive, because these storms are catastrophic for those regions. But in 2005, Hurricane Katrina, we saw over 1,800 deaths, right, as a result of, and that's an estimated number because we don't know exactly how many died because of Hurricane Katrina, but we had 1,800 deaths, we had levees that were breached, we had over $125 billion in damage to New Orleans, and that recovery effort lasted years. I was there, you know, a year and a half after Katrina, and the devastation was still rampant downtown. And so you look at where New Orleans has come, and the fact that, yeah, we have people without power, but we aren't seeing the massive death toll yet, right? There's still a lot of things ahead of us on this, but I think that the region in some ways is better prepared for this strength of a storm. And hopefully going forward that, you know, as these storms come and they go and they impact the area, hopefully we get better at people being prepared and that our drainage systems get better and that we find better ways of helping people to, you know, to get through these devastating tragedies. That's the one bright light I have. We were well over hundreds of deaths after week one of Katrina, and the devastation was a lot worse. And so I know that there are probably many people that are grateful that this isn't as bad as Katrina was, but still, your heart goes out to people that are suffering.
Well, and you know, even thinking to the long term, the human tragedy, I don't want to minimize that. It's horrific, and hopefully we do minimize that the deaths and the human tragedy. But Congress is poised to pass a massive infrastructure investment bill. One of the things we always talked about when I was in Congress is about the importance of doing that in a way, investing in climate resilient infrastructure. We are seeing and will continue to see more storms, more fires, more extreme weather events as a result of climate change. And I hope that we're not just rebuilding in the same way, but we're doing it in a way that can minimize the loss of human life and the loss of infrastructure in the future, that we are aware and recognize the impacts of climate change are real and having an impact. And so we build in a way that's financially as wise stewards of our tax dollars.
I just read that over 30% of Americans lived in a climate disaster over this summer. So we're talking about people who are in multiple days of extreme heat or living near fires or dealing with flooding. And all of these issues are becoming more frequent. And so I would love to turn our attention a little bit here to infrastructure. What is happening with the infrastructure bill? Where are we at? And are we going to see those investments really coming in the way that we need them to?
Yeah, so I was talking to some of my colleagues, my former colleagues in the House, about really the quandary right now is between progressive Democrats and some of the centrist Democrats about the infrastructure bill itself that received votes through the Senate. It has the votes to pass in the House in an overwhelmingly bipartisan way, but it's being linked to the $3.5 trillion, what they're calling human infrastructure bill. You know, other things, not necessarily roads and bridges, but sick leave or
childcare,
other things that are equally important in different ways. And so that's you know, really one of the things that's happening right now. Let me just make a quick side note. So I one of the things I love now that I'm not in Congress, I drive my kids to school every day. So I'm driving my son to school this morning, and on the way to school, my son, this is what every Democrat parent dreams of. My son says, "Dad, what is Labor Day about?" So we like immediately turn off the radio and we say, I gave him the whole, you know, I'm raising a good little Democrat there, gave him the whole spiel about what Labor Day is and why it's important. But I had to note, it was the same time on NPR that they're talking about how unemployment benefits have terminated. They ran out on Labor Day.
Right.
And so we're talking about physical infrastructure, roads and bridges, but also the human infrastructure. And you know, I'm a fiscal conservative. I believe in balanced budgets and living within our means. But there's some tension there. I'd love to hear your thoughts about not only physical infrastructure, but some of this human infrastructure investment.
I'll let you go, Dan.
I was gonna say it's interesting. And this is true of the Democrats as much as it is for the Republicans. There's like two parties really within each of the parties, right? And it happens here on the state level just as much as it does on the federal level. And it's really interesting, you know, when Republicans are in control, how difficult it is to get those centrist Republicans to do something, right? And there's always those eyes on those folks. And now when the Democrats are in control, there's a lot of eyes. For example, Senator Manchin was not a household name, you know, for the last 20 years as he served in this federal Senate. But he is now. And everybody, you know, that pays attention to the goings on, everybody wants to know, what does Senator Manchin of West Virginia say? And how does he feel about the issue? And because that will tell you whether or not it's going to get legs in the Senate and whether or not it's going to get that magical 60 votes. So and then you watch, of course, the party within the parties, those two parties fighting against each other. I love watching AOC light her own party on fire because, you know, it's always entertaining. And I don't like it when my party does it, I guess, which I just suffered through 4 years of a president lighting his own party on fire for no reason, it seemed. But, you know, here we have AOC kind of taking that same tact.
But I would say, I think that there's clearly a debate going on within our own party, but there's also what's happening in the public. And when you go ask people what they want, if you ask them if they would like to see greater investments in childcare, if you would like to see greater investments in elder care, the ability to know that if you took a job that you would have a safe place for your child to go. Like all of these elements of the human infrastructure package are very popular. Asking corporations to pay their fair share, very popular. Expanding healthcare, reducing drug prices, many of the things that we're talking about that need to happen here to really move our society forward, to create greater opportunity for more people to really contribute to their fullest. That's popular with the American people. So while we can have this fight between Joe Manchin and AOC, I think it's important to understand what is it that people are talking about at their kitchen tables and what do they need.
So one of the things that, like, I want to maybe move it away from substance and talk about process a little bit. As a centrist Democrat, first of all, I had the best training for learning to be a consensus builder because I was a Democrat in Utah, right? And I didn't get anything done unless I learned to build bridges and work across the aisle. So when I see AOC tweeting things like, she's entitled to her perspective, but when she's tweeting things about Joe Manchin being corrupt because he doesn't agree with her, I actually sat next to AOC. We were seatmates on the House Financial Services Committee. I got to know her pretty well. And we had a friendly relationship, but I have to admit that one of the lines that I said that I would never cross as a Democrat in the Utah State Senate, as a Democratic mayor with a Republican council, is I say, you're entitled to disagree on policy till the sun goes down. You never question someone's values. You always give them the benefit of the doubt. And look, there are times that there are people, I think, who deserve to have their values questioned. But by and large, people are in this to serve for the right reason. Joe Manchin, I think, has a perspective. He also represents a state that's very conservative. He has a perspective. Agree or disagree with him, you got to give him the dignity of standing up for his state and standing up for what he believes in. And that's a perspective. And there's a difference between having a different perspective and being corrupt.
I agree.
So you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm here with State Senator Dan McKay and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
And I'm Ben McAdams in the political middle. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. So we want to start off this segment talking about something pretty heavy. So the U.S. Supreme Court this week, first of all, declined to weigh in and overturn the Texas abortion law. Really pretty complicated, legally complicated. Shireen, why don't you walk us through exactly what happened and what that means?
Yeah, so I actually think I'm going to leave Dan to talk about what happened in terms of at the Supreme Court, how the decision was, well, lack of decision was made and what that means. But just to set this up, if people aren't paying attention to what's happening in Texas right now, it is an absolutely, I find this law particularly concerning. It should be concerning for anyone who believes that your healthcare, that the reproductive choices you make or otherwise, your otherwise healthcare choices are your private business. Are they your private business, or is it the business of random citizens of Texas who have now been deputized to report individuals who are seeking an abortion after 6 weeks? For me, this level of intrusion into people's lives when they're making a deeply difficult decision is absolutely the wrong way to go about reducing abortions in this country, first of all. Secondly, I should add, abortions are coming down, and a big part of the reason they've come down is because of the ACA. More people have access to affordable health care at critical times in their life, in their childbearing years, and that is helping to drive down the overall rate of abortions in this country. We could do more to expand access to health care and drive that number down. We could do more to support people so when they found out they got pregnant, that they would be able to carry that individual into this world. That is not what this law does. What this law does is force pregnancy on people who do not find out that they're pregnant within that 6 week window. And it relies on neighbors, on random strangers to get involved in this process to report individuals. I think this is the level of surveillance that should bother every American. But what happened at the Supreme Court is also something that requires a little explanation. So, Dan, can you help explain? This is not a decision. This is actually a lack of decision. And can you talk about why that happened?
Well, the Supreme Court is always trying to find procedural issues to deal with matters that come before the court. And you'll frequently find, you know, in Supreme Court opinions where the fault, they will actually not get to the measure of the law or the constitutionality of the law that's there, but they will frequently deal with procedural. And in this situation, you know, the Supreme Court even was really clear. I'm just quoting from the opinion, an unsigned opinion, by the way. In particular, this order is not based on any conclusion about the constitutionality of the Texas law and in no way limits other procedural proper challenges to the Texas law, including in Texas state courts, which I think the Supreme Court is saying you're here too quickly. Right? You are trying to skip procedural steps to force a federal ban or protection, but there are states injunctions, there are federal injunctions at the lower courts, and those have procedural merits and measures that need to be dealt with prior to, you know, to us addressing whether or not those procedures have been followed. And I get it, like the courts are, sometimes they're your best friends and sometimes they're your worst friends, which is why any time a client asks me, you know, we definitely win in court, and I'd say, and Ben will probably laugh, well, it depends. Because which is a classic lawyer response, but it really does depend. And following the proper procedural deal, that is what lawyers make their whole life out of. And I think in this situation, you had certain interest groups running immediately to the Supreme Court asking for an injunction on the Texas law. And the Supreme Court saying, wait a second, you're skipping like a lot of procedural steps. Just go back and deal with the procedural issues. And then, you know, you can certainly come to us with the constitutionality claims at a later time. But let's make sure the process is right, which is honestly the Supreme Court's way in frequent cases. And you saw this actually in the Second Amendment case not too long ago, where the court just steps back and takes a procedural problem and gloms onto that problem. So there is no ruling on constitutionality. There is no like it's a final like this is. There is a long way to go, and I would argue probably multiple years, several injunctions and procedural issues before anyone is, in Shireen's words, forced into having a pregnancy. But
so actually that's not correct, because it's in effect right now, and that's the problem, right? So, and at the same time, I just want to add this detail. At the same time, Mexico has decriminalized, their Supreme Court decriminalized abortion. And so what this means is that people with resources will be able to move right across that border if they find out after 6 weeks, which is actually incredibly early. Most people don't even realize that they're pregnant at that stage. So if they miss that 6 week window in Texas, those with resources will be able to cross the border and they will be able to make the right reproductive health choices for them, right? But those who do not have resources will be stuck in Texas and they will be forced to carry that pregnancy because that is in place right now. And I think I think we should all be very concerned when that level of surveillance, deputizing random individuals to get into your business, is terrible policy. But I guess let's just, Ben, I'm going to kick it to you because I know Dan would go on forever about this.
No, I'll just say there was a procedural filing the very next morning in the state district court asking for an injunction to enjoin the law, and they're waiting for that hearing. So what I would just tell you is, yeah, it's, you know, from the Supreme Court's refusal, it's been in effect, I think, 4 actual days. And so give the courts time. The process will be followed.
Well, let me just add, maybe speaking to the process. First of all, this is an incredibly complex topic. I think politicians love to oversimplify it and oversimplify it in the minds of voters. It's complex. And anytime someone's making a decision about terminating a pregnancy, there is emotional trauma at the individual level that's immense. You know, in the Texas law doesn't have exemptions for rape or incest. Life of the mother. It really is kind of a blunt tool. And as I understand it, this was conceived of as a means of using the private right of action. So for the non-lawyers out there, that means that typically you would see a violator, the government can come in and prosecute that, and immediately you can litigate to look to overturn that law. Because this is a private right of action, the reason that the courts can't intervene at this point and why there's, as Shireen has said, no action is because you don't know who the litigant is. And so you can't bring a case before the Supreme Court when you don't have parties. So this was intentionally conceived to evade judicial review by using this private right of action. I think that is incredibly problematic. The courts have to figure out how to grapple with this, because this notion, again, of using neighbor versus neighbor on neighbor surveillance isn't just going to be used for causes on the right. It can also be used by causes on the left. Think of a progressive state using gun, you know, looking to stop gun rights and using this private right of action to avoid constitutional review on gun legislation. I think it is incredibly
problematic. Can you imagine neighbors reporting other neighbors over a COVID-19 breach during a quarantine? Can you imagine, you know, neighbor reporting neighbor for, you know, just go down the list of all the, think of water, you know, water wasting and that kind of stuff. I would just say, before we condemn water, you know, neighbor versus neighbor, sounding like it's private enforcement, before we condemn that, just realize we use it all the time. And so, but more common.
Not to avoid judicial review. These are in ways that are already legally established and permissible, but to evade the courts in a way that I think upsets the constitutional balance of power is really problematic. I want to maybe use that to transfer to another topic where we're talking about a different approach, and this is news today in Utah on the death penalty, right? So I was reading, maybe it wasn't today, but it was this week, Representative Lowry Snow and State Senator Dan McKay are bringing legislation to repeal and replace Utah's death penalty. Dan, why don't you describe exactly what the bill's doing and some of your thoughts behind that?
Well, you know, thanks. It's been an adventure for me. You know, back in 2014 or 16, I can't remember, when Representative Paul Ray brought forth a bill that basically reinstituted the use of the firing squad for the death penalty. Yeah. And the vote was deadlocked in the House, and, you know, it already passed the Senate and was deadlocked in the House. And I had voted against it because of my feelings about the death penalty. And then when I stopped, thought about it, and realized we were only talking about a method and not necessarily about like the death penalty, I flipped and was the deciding vote in favor of letting the firing squad be an issue. But that like led off this, you know, soul searching, you know, thing that kind of got me where we are today, where Lowry Snow and I have been working on trying to do away with the death penalty. I mean, we've been working for a couple of years now with colleagues, and it's been an intense labor trying to, you know, figure out where people are on the issue. The bill itself will be very simple.
Can I pause you right there, Dan? I want to, first of all, I didn't know that Dan McKay had a soul. So soul searching.
Listeners.
That's really, oh, wait.
Breaking news.
No. But no, I think listeners would love to hear some of your thoughts on this. You talk about your soul searching and your personal thoughts on it. If you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about what brings you to the point that you're sponsoring this bill. Typically, Republicans are all about the death penalty and to stereotype, right? And Democrats are all about repealing it. I'd love to just, if you can, just real quickly tell us some of your thoughts and what, where did that soul searching lead you? Why are you running this bill?
Well, you know, I read a lot. I'm a vociferous reader, and so I spend and I'm not afraid to read anything. And once was it was recommended to me that I read The Sun Does Shine, which is a story of a death row inmate who was acquitted after being wrongly accused. And, you know, there were a lot of problems with his conviction. There was very little evidence and, you know, DNA came about and overturned it, but he suffered for 20 plus years in prison. And that book started kind of a change of thought and process. I have a hard time, honestly, thinking that a justice system is moral, ethical, or anything when we're trying to take a life. And it doesn't matter, you know, and Shireen and I have gotten into it about abortion in on this program and in previous. But I really like, you think the only way to be consistently pro-life is to be in favor of everyone's life. And that if they're, you know, if you're not protecting someone actively in the middle of being harmed, that it's really hard for the government to argue that a person should be killed. And that's one part of it. I think if you add the conservative case for it, which is death row inmates cost the system three times what normal inmates cost, right? A normal inmate is about $25,000 a year. You take their lifespan, you spread all those costs out, but you're talking about a 3x multiplier just because they're on death row. Health benefits, everything else the same. And then you look at the fact that 10% over the last 40 years, 10% of death row inmates have been completely exonerated of the crimes that they were committed of. So not only is the government killing people, but the government
is killing
the wrong people.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so those the cost, the ethics, morality of, you know, of the government killing people, then you start to get even deeper into the inadequate enforcement of, you know, and how race ties into who is actually executed. Now in Utah, we haven't had the race issue. We've been focused mostly on, you know, we've only executed white people, I think. I can't remember that. I'm sure 100%, but those kinds of things are big problems. The bill, though, just to be real quick, because Anthony's like saying, McKay, wrap it up. The bill really quickly will just replace the death penalty and take it off the table. But it will add another option for prosecutors with a 45-year to life sentence. So we have a 25-year to life, and now we'll have 45 years so the prosecutors will still have negotiating room with people who've committed heinous acts. And you saw the Utah County Attorney just today came out and said he's actually withdrawing the death penalty as an option for sentencing from one of the existing cases. A Republican Utah County. Mind blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I know that this is all heavy news, but I just need to acknowledge there are 7 people on death row right now in Utah. The one who's been there the longest has been there for 36 years. There is just not I'm so grateful that you're doing this, and I think that it's so important. And I would also just encourage people, if you care about this issue, now is a great time to shoot off an email to the governor and let him know where you stand on it. If you would like to see the death penalty end, contact your representatives. I don't think I'm overstating that you shouldn't assume that every Democrat is on board. Contact your legislators, contact your representatives, and let them know this matters to you. I would be so proud if we move this forward, and I'm grateful, Dan, that you're doing it.
Well, I just have to do things like this to prove that I have a soul, Shireen.
Dan and I, just for the listeners, Dan and I are good friends. We often disagree, but we do have a good friendship. We text and razz each other all the time. So
it's well deserved.
It's been a heavy show. Real quick, good news: BYU versus Utah this weekend. I think the good news is the Utes walk away with it. Anyone else want to share a moment of good news?
I mean, I'm a big go Utes girl. Let's do it.
I'll just take the Cougars because it's expected.
Okay. As you would do if you had no soul.
As you do if you had no soul.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be with you both today.
Thank you for sitting in.
Thank you. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Ben McAdams. I've been joined by State Senator Dan McKay and Shireen Gourbani. Thank you to our producer, Anthony Scoma. And thank you for listening.